Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. I don't know if you knew this, but anyone can get the same premium wireless for $15 a month plan that I've been enjoying. It's not just for celebrities. So do like I did and have one of your assistant's assistants switch you to Mint Mobile today. I'm told it's super easy to do at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're there. There's so much going on today, and there's a lot of action to talk about. The president's going to have his normal lunch, his weekly lunch with the vice president of the United States. We got a press secretary who's going to have her briefing today around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And the president also participates in a swearing-in ceremony for the chief of protocol, and that is Monica Crowley. Congratulations to her. And now hopefully this goes smoother than the last time, where basically everybody was weaponized to get people like Monica Crowley and Mike Flynn and some others just made sure they never got traction. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The hardest thing to do now and forever and has ever been is to cut spending. When you have tiny margins, you're trying to pass a big bill. I think in the end it will pass, but don't expect it to be as beautiful as the president would like.
But the tax cuts will be permanent, and that'll be key, too. That's the big, beautiful bill. Now, Elon Musk is gone, and he's critical of the big, beautiful bill. Doge remains, what it all means for Trump's economy and the midterms.
Number two.
We're going to see where the trail leads, just like we did in the Biden influence peddling investigation. We're going to do the same thing with this auto pen. Who was giving the authority for use of the auto pen?
Nothing but facts. Biden confidants called to Congress to talk about who was really running the country while Biden was president, showing up willingly whether they show up willingly or court mandated. The political scandal threatens the Dems today and tomorrow.
Number one.
Harvard has been a disaster. They've taken $5 billion plus. And I'd rather see that money go to trade schools.
Yeah, we'll see if that can be repurposed. War on Harvard getting uglier as the Trump crackdown continues with the Ivy president speaking out and confessing about the state of his once elite institution. Yeah, they got professors, but there's no diversity of thought. Yes, they do a lot of studies and have respect around the world, but at what cost? Could we be cost effective elsewhere with just pure labs and no university setting? So the president of the United States says we're going to also examine should there be thresholds to international students at universities. I think yes. I mean, my goodness, they get 27% of the student body, as many as 32%, are from other countries. All right, how about 15? President brought that up. I think it should be a lot less. Also, stop with the biasness. Cut one.
Harvard has been a disaster. They've taken $5 billion plus. $5 billion. Nobody knew that they were making this cut. If we didn't do this, nobody would have. We would have never found this out, Pam. They're taking $5 billion, and I'd rather see that money go to trade schools.
And what happens is Karl Rove told us yesterday, you got to go name the schools and talk about how you're going to repurpose the money, but go and do it. You can't just say what trade schools. As Michael Rowe said, too, he said, they're all trade schools that aren't great. Find out what the ones they are, good ones are, and you can help that way with blue-collar workers and see if you can repurpose some of that. But still, they're continuing to fight. They're going to court. They'll be in court today trying to get their reinstatement for student visas to be able to issue them and get their new freshman class going and renew the ones that are still there. Alan Garber, the current Harvard president, was on NPR. And he's talking about the fight he's having with Trump. And he did talk openly about the problem they're having with conservatives. Cut 10.
We think it's a real problem. If particularly at research universities, students don't feel free to speak their minds, when faculty feel that they have to think twice before they talk about the subjects that they're teaching, that's a real problem that we need to address. And it's particularly concerning when people who have views that they think are unpopular, and the administration and others have said conservatives are too few on campus and their views are not welcome. And so far as that's true, that's a problem we really need to address.
Is it true?
I think that we have heard from some people that they do feel that way.
Yeah, people feel that way. So it's a bit of a couch. So they feel they're going to outlast. They're wasting money trying to fight the government. And in the end, they lose the American public, even if they win some of the cases along the way. It's a real problem. And Harvard doesn't seem to care or fully understand. Where Columbia says, how do I unfreeze my $400 million? They're saying now, how do I get my $30 billion back? Yeah, the State Department is also now scrutinizing all visa holders associated with Harvard, not just student visas. That includes B1 business visas, B2 tourist visas, and others. It'll be a substantive investigation aimed at identifying potential security vulnerabilities or other abuses of the visa system. This is going to Bill Malusian. This could potentially impact hundreds of individuals associated with the university. So good job, Harvard. Dig in, get your court order and go to court and realize the American people are fed up with foreigners taking slots at elite institutions. You just want the full freight, no doubt about it. Congressman Gregory Meeks thinks he's on Harvard's side. Cut 8.
This is about retribution. This is about individuals, as we've seen again and again. Universities, law firms, any individual that Trump perceives to be his enemy. It's about retribution. It's about him wanting to be a king. This is a danger and a violation of the Constitution of the United States of America, which does give individuals the freedom of speech.
So this is unbelievable that they still use his terms. If it's not Hitler, they use the term king. So they keep on doing this. He wants to make himself king. No, he doesn't want to put up with anti-Semitism on college campuses. And Congressman Meeks, you said nothing. Senator Schumer, you've said almost nothing. You coach people to keep their mouth shut. And now that the president says, I'm not going to tolerate it, let alone the conservative school of thought, it's crazy. Linda McMahon, who's going to be out on Long Island tomorrow in Massapequa going to bat for the American Indian names like Chiefs and Warriors. She said this about Harvard. Cut 7.
The president is looking at Harvard because, I mean, if you think about where did a lot of this anti-Semitism start, or where were the actions that we saw that were covered in the media? Harvard was clearly one of those places. Columbia was the other. The goal really is to have Harvard come to the table. Let's negotiate. Let's work through the things that we have put forward that we believe are going to make things better on the campus of Harvard. We did that with Columbia. I think that we're making great strides.
Yeah, but they're not doing it, so they want to fight it. We'll see how that goes. Same with CBS and Paramount. They want to fight against the president when the president sued them, when the White House sued them for election bias, for editing and making Kamala Harris seem sane. They offered $15 million. The president said, not enough, I want $25. So the other big question is, what's going on with the Democratic Party? Not only where do they go from here, but what's been happening over the last 4 years. Now it seems, and books confirm, that Joe Biden was not in charge. And look at the left-wing agenda. You look at the amount of pardons that were handed out. You look at the end of natural gas drilling at a critical time of our national security. When you see the Arctic ban on drilling, you wonder, whose idea was that? Was Joe Biden even knowing that he was signing off on it? Here's Congressman Jim Comer, cut 11.
I would say Ron Klain's a very good bet. But again, we're going to see where the trail leads, just like we did in the Biden influence peddling investigation. We followed the money. We found the shell companies. We found the bank accounts. We're going to do the same thing with this auto pen. Who was giving the authority for use of the auto pen? Remember, Sean, there was more activity in the last 100 days of the Biden administration than the first 3.5 years of the Biden administration. Many of the far-reaching executive orders were signed during the last 100 days, and they were all signed by the auto pen. We don't believe that you can sign a legal document with an auto pen. If I issue a subpoena, I have to fly to Washington, D.C. to manually sign my signature on that subpoena. Anything pertaining to the law has to be signed by a person.
That's pretty insane. And I don't know if you could tell the difference with the auto pen, but I would have to go ahead and try to authenticate all of it, that it's Joe Biden's policy. But Joe Biden, is he all there to talk about what he did over the last 4 years? He's been defiant, saying he's never been better, trying to convince everyone that he's fine. Do you think he's going to say, well, I'm dementia ridden and all these people took advantage of me? That's not going to happen. So James Comer said that the Biden White House blocked individuals from providing testimony in the past. But now, if they don't show up, he will subpoena them and make them legally bound to show up. Remember, people that didn't show up, some went to prison, like Steve Bannon, for not showing up to testify. So Joe Biden and that scandal, I am for looking forward, but I would like to find out who was complicit, because I want to eliminate them from higher office. Alex Thompson, co-author of the big book that's outing a lot of the antics of the administration, was there last night, was on our channel last night, Cut 14.
John Anzalone, who worked with Biden back in 1987 and was the pollster in 2020, he raises concerns about him running for re-election and thinks they should, like, have a real process here. And he basically is told no thanks. And he's not part of the Biden re-election. I'd say the other thing is that's happened to a lot of people in that world. And I would say the main enforcer of sort of the loyalty principles is Jill Biden and Anthony Bernal. But as a result, people get the memo and people don't speak up because, I mean, honestly, I think it's like more of a story of cowardice where they feel like they're going to be pushed out. Now, there were small little things done, like, for example, Bob Bauer, Anita Dunn's husband and Biden's longtime lawyer. They basically secretly had the DNC get a copy of the hard drive from Hunter Biden's laptop, prepare a dossier of sorts of like the most salacious details, and then privately present it to Joe and Jill Biden. And the message was, all of this is going to come out this time. Like, we're not going to
2024.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to get away with it like we did in 2020. All this, and like, it's going to be very painful.
And it's going to be introduced as evidence in his trial also.
Yes.
Hey, yeah. And by the way, with his son, is still a mess. A lot of those financial ties, the cocaine in the White House, all this stuff could be exposed. So how, if he had run and he had won, how would they have done it? Here's more from Thompson of what these people and his sources told him. What would have happened?
There was one person, and I remember it, especially because it was said so casually, where they said, listen, when you all Biden had to do was win, and then he only had to occasionally come out for an occasional proof of life. And
they used the phrase proof of life.
Yeah. And their rationale was, first, beating Trump, but B, they were like, when you vote for a president, I think most voters understand you're voting for the people around them, too.
This is all
that is
stunning, right? All of the interviews for this book took place after the election, except for that one. And it's to me the most stunning, because it was not the most stunning. There's a lot of stunning stuff in the book, but just the rationalization of proof of life. Like, what are you talking about? That's not what the job is. You know, I mean, it's something out of like a dystopian Hollywood thriller.
So think about this. These people you probably never heard of are going to be called up and they're going to be asked to describe what they did. I don't know why they're going to be honest. Joe Biden's not going to come up there and say it's not true. He'll agree with everything if asked. Neera Tanden, we know her. Andy Tomasini, okay, we've seen her. Anthony Bernal, very close to the Biden family for years. And Ashley Williamson was the deputy director of the Oval Office. So she'd be able to comment on things, but I don't expect them to say anything. But what I think is interesting, maybe some direct questions or abstentions from Democrats who don't want to attack because they don't want to defend, excuse me, they rather attack. They don't want to defend Joe Biden. They don't want that stain on them should they want to seek higher office or their current office. So you don't want to be like, Joe Biden was all in. This is the best version of Joe Biden ever. You will not hear that from anyone not named Jill. Jamie Metzl at the bottom of the hour. Your call's next, 1-866-408-7669. Brian Kilmeade.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So, you know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the DOGE team is doing.
I actually thought that when this big, beautiful bill came along, I mean, like, everything he's done on DOGE gets wiped out in the first year.
I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful, but I don't know if it could be both. My personal opinion.
That is Elon Musk coming out talking about the Doge cuts as it relates to the big, beautiful bill. And when Trump came back, it very cogently just said, look, there's some things I don't like about the bill. But we have a lot of people that have to get on board from all different walks of life within our same party with very small margins. So what he's trying to say is, Elon, this is not the Board of Trustees situation. Now, think about it. Elon, with all his brilliance, got ousted from PayPal because he could not convince his board to go along with what he was saying. And he still wrestles a lot with his other companies that he created. Now, how do you deal with 434 members of Congress in the House? How do you deal with 100 senators? So then you say, oh, you'll have to deal with my party. Good luck. Okay. How do you deal with 219 congressmen? How do you deal with 53 senators who disagree on substantial things because of the places they're from and their personal ideologies? What you do is you put together a bill like this, you have to compromise and not get everything you want. So he did not react personally to it. I'm upset. I'm not upset, but I'm disappointed that Elon Musk left, but I'm encouraged that he has left his team behind, and because his team's going to continue to work. Here's Donald Trump responding, cut 16.
We have to get a lot of votes. We can't be cutting. You know, we need to get a lot of support, and we have a lot of support. We had to get it through the House. We will be negotiating that bill, and I'm not happy about certain aspects of it, but I'm thrilled by other aspects of it.
Right, and for the most part, he'll go in there and cut other ways. When it comes to Elon Musk, he says they will be making those cuts permanent and putting in a rescission package. OMB Director Russ Vogt was asked about this with Larry Kudlow. Say they have all these cuts. Why not just put them into the budget, make it official, cut 19?
We'll be sending that up on Monday or Tuesday, whenever the House is back in session. They will get our first rescissions bill. And again, this has been proposed, and we've talked about it. We want to make sure that Congress passes its first rescissions bill, including the DOGE, and we will send more if they pass it.
Right. Once they pass it, things like cutting PBS, cutting USAID will be controversy, cutting certain projects, a new Green Deal, a lot of things surrounding that. That's going to be a big deal. So Russ Vogt is the OMB director. No one is the most person who really understands the bottom line. Here's where he's going to focus on first to make Elon Musk work permanent, cut 20.
So this is the first one is foreign aid. USAID cuts many of the waste and garbage that was funding, not only wasteful, but hurting our foreign policy, but also the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and NPR. We'll be sending that up, and we're working with Congress. And we've had good conversations to make sure that they knew what was coming. They had some input as to changes that could be made to make it something that could pass the House.
Yeah, there are going to be some changes, hopefully not substantial, where the House has got to go reconvene the Freedom Caucus, get them together with the moderate SALT Caucus and try to hedge and patch something together or Frankenstein it together. So that's what you deal with. I think that when the president said, I'm not touching entitlements, it really limited how much you can do because politically it might have been detrimental to do just that. So we're going to talk about with Jamie Metzl and talk about what's happening with China yesterday. The Secretary of State says we are going to put a hold on all Chinese students until we can background check them into our colleges to make sure they're not, I don't know, spies, communist spies. Most of them are. Stanford just uncovered a spy ring May 7th. And most of them are because what they say is go over there, tell us what you can see, tell us what you can find. And if there's any problem with your loyalty, if you want to stay or defect, keep in mind your family's still here. So that's the leverage. Jamie Metzl coming up next, former member of the WHO and advisory committee, former National Security Council official in the Clinton administration. He's got a new column out. The White House dismisses scores of National Security Council staff. Why? The president does not trust him, looks at them as the deep state. Don't move.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back. Jamie Metzl in studio, former member of the WHO Advisory Committee, former National Security Council official with the Clinton administration and author of Super Convergence. Jamie, we've got so many different places to go, but let's talk about what's happening today. I guess Harvard has a graduation.
Yes.
And we're going to be covering it live where we expect anti-Semitic protests to rage, anti-Israeli specifically. Yeah. And a lot of people look at this and understand, in speaking to the hostage lawyers, there's a genesis of Hamas funding and Iran funding that supports some of these four Palestinian programs at Harvard.
So I'm on two sides of this issue, proudly. I'm a Harvard alum, and I think Harvard is an incredible institution, and it is a gem of America, and America is a beneficiary of Harvard and everything that it represents. And Harvard and universities like it have a major problem. We have let incitement run amok. We have foreign funding for very destructive behaviors. We have pit one group of students against others. And so this bubble needed to be popped. As I was saying to you, Brian, before we went live, as a Democrat, I wish the Democrats had said, hey, a lot of this stuff is just nuts and we need to go after it. Because the Democrats weren't able to police ourselves, the American public felt they have the Democrats who are just embracing defund the police and globalize the intifada and all these horrible things that the Democrats couldn't fully condemn. And President Trump, who was saying this stuff is a threat to America and American democracy. And so there wasn't really an option. So I absolutely think that we need to address the kind of incitement to violence and rank anti-Semitism that we are seeing in American universities. I also think that we need to be very careful when we're doing that, because our universities have made incredible contributions to our societal, national well-being, our economic well-being, winning wars. All of these kinds of things are connected to our universities. So we can't take a sledgehammer to a problem that's better addressed with a scalpel.
So I think, though, Harvard has themselves to blame, in my view, because Columbia got their $400 million frozen, and they said, what do I have to do to get it back?
Yeah.
And they basically agreed to everything except for the curriculum, one, where they feel as though they want to negotiate, which I think is expected. And I can understand both sides of that one. You see this, you wonder if they could balance out some of the curriculum to not be so anti-American when it comes to international studies or however they label it. And Harvard goes, no, we're going to sue you. You know, if you sue, if you freeze this money, you take this money, you repurpose this money, we're suing you. So the administration goes, okay, we're going to amp this up. We're going to hold back $50 billion. And by the way, you got a huge endowment. The money that was coming to you, we're going to repurpose to trade schools. Now, there's a way to do that. That's interesting. And then are you entitled as a university to get grants from the federal government? That's what a judge is going to ultimately decide. Here's what President Trump also said about the fact that between 27 and 32% of the student body is from another country. Cut three.
We want to be able to see why, you know, these countries aren't helping us. They're not investing in Harvard and all of our, we are. I think, number one, I think they should have a cap of maybe around 15%, not 31%. We have people who want to go to Harvard and other schools. They can't get in because we have foreign students there. But I want to make sure that the foreign students are people that can love our country.
Is there anything he said you can't sign on to?
I'm not sure I would sign on to a specific percentage. I agree that American universities should prioritize educating Americans. But America has been a huge beneficiary of getting the best and brightest students from other places coming here and then moving here and living their lives here. And most of Silicon Valley is people exactly like that. Either it's refugees like Sergey Brin, or people who came here to study and stayed on. So we are beneficiaries of this system. But absolutely, we should be filtering out. If there are people who are either members of communist parties elsewhere or people who are coming to our campuses and they are calling to globalize the intifada or do all of these things supporting designated terrorist organizations, like, we should have no room for that. So we do need to do a better job of right. screening, but I wouldn't support specific quotas.
I think it would be great. As also, no one brings this up, but as a sports team, I'm watching Division I soccer.
Yeah.
There's no Americans. You got 25-year-old freshmen from other countries. I'm thinking to myself, who are you rooting for? So it's like, well, I love that university, really, because they just transferred over here. They couldn't get in the Premier League. And I'm watching, maybe it's the same thing with basketball, too, to a degree, but there's more American basketball players. So
yeah, but that'll make us better. I mean, I just feel like, you know, I'm originally from Kansas City. When I was a little kid, I used to say, well, how many members of the Chiefs are from Kansas City? I want to be part of the team where all the players come from Kansas City. It helps us in the United States. If we want to be great at soccer, let's bring the best people, soccer players, to come here and play, and let's bring up our game.
But they're taking
game.
The spots of American kids.
Yeah, well, but
I'd rather American kids have a chance to compete than a 23-year-old.
Yeah, but half of the U.S. World Cup team are people who came here.
Those
as
are
students.
Americans.
Yeah, there's students, but also people come in. It's great for America if amazing people from other countries come here, get educated, move here, build their lives here, have kids here who play soccer like their parents from Argentina or Colombia. I think that's the story of America. And I think if we become too rigid, but for sure, if there are people like is happening with some students from China, some of the definitely pregnant women flying to Los Angeles to give birth in Los Angeles to get. I mean, there are real problems. People
the
are
birthright citizenship.
Yeah, people are exploiting.
Which is,
exploiting.
I can't believe both parties can't get on board that. Yeah. That's not what it was meant to do.
It was not.
And people are abusing that.
People are finding loopholes in our system, and we need to say, here's what we are for. And I'm just worried that while we have to identify problems and address them, if we take a sledgehammer to all of these problems and do too much damage to our educational system and other systems, it's going to be very, very difficult to build. These things take decades, centuries to build, and they can be destroyed very quickly.
So Secretary of State Marco Rubio said this: the U.S. will begin revoking visas of Chinese students, including those with connections to the Chinese Communist Party or studying in critical fields. Under President Trump's leadership, the U.S. State Department will work with the Department of Homeland to revoke visas for Chinese students, including those with connections, as I mentioned. He goes on to say, we will revise visa criteria to enhance scrutiny of all future visa applications from the People's Republic of China and Hong Kong, which is now one and the same. How do you feel about that?
Well, we have some incredible young people from China, from Hong Kong in our universities who are contributing massively to scientific research, to all aspects of
academic
life. We also have people who are coming from China, who are stealing things, who are intimidating. There's massive intimidation.
Stanford had a big story. Everywhere.
I mean, massive intimidation of other students by students from China connected to the Chinese Communist Party who are spying on other students and reporting back. I am all for screening students who aren't working, so to prevent students from coming here under the guise of education and working as agents of foreign governments. But we also need to recognize, again, America is a huge beneficiary of the inflow of students. We actually have a problem of kicking out too many students who are coming here to study. But I think it's a healthy impulse
but
to say we need to be mindful.
Don't you worry about China in that the story is when they come over here, even if they're the most well-meaning, their families are behind, and they threaten the families if the kids do not, the students
sure,
do not produce.
It's that is a vulnerability. We need to address that vulnerability.
Do you like the way he's addressing it?
I don't like it. I think it's too broad. I think we should say, here's the specific problem, and here's how we're going to address it specifically.
But this is the problem, and this is how he's going to address it. He's going to address every visa. So they have 240,000 Chinese students.
Yeah, so but I think, for example, when people apply for these visas, there are a series of questions that you ask. And one is, have you ever been a member of a communist party?
Everybody has.
And
in China.
Not everybody, but a lot of these people. But I think maybe you should say there should be more questions that. But I think we could ask, for example, have you ever supported in any way, including on social media posts, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization? So all these kids, because we had this mania of globalize the intifada who posted on social media, they're all racing, which is healthy, actually, to erase their inciting to violence social media posts. I do think we should screen. But again, if we just say we're against Chinese students as a broad category, we're going to do a lot of harm to ourselves. We need to say this is the problem that we're trying to address, and we're going to address it narrowly.
But do you with that, I say the same thing, farmland. You're buying farmland in America, you're China, you got to be no. When you buy land near military bases, yeah, it's got to be no. I don't need any ramp up. I don't need to be Chinese or Russian, because we can't have that.
We've let our openness be used against us. And we had this fantasy. I mean, I served in the Clinton administration, but I think the Clinton administration did a terrible thing. It was a huge error to let China into the WTO without sufficient conditionality. And certainly Democrats and Republican administrations didn't do enough to hold China accountable. But yes, these things are kind of obvious that we need to be protecting against our adversaries. And the governments of China and Russia are our enemies.
So let's talk about anti-Semitism. You just told me the couple that was gunned down just from going to that Jewish event in Washington, D.C. They were a future couple about to be engaged.
Right.
They were, one of them was a friend of your family?
Yeah. Well, her, so her father was a close friend of my father's. I come from Kansas City. I live in New York now, but I come from Kansas City originally. And we have a pretty tight-knit Jewish community there. And her father was a biking partner of my father, my late father, for decades. And so I knew everybody here. And it's just so – and this young woman, Sarah Milgram, was just incredible. I mean, she was so committed to coexistence. The actual meeting that she was attending, which is organized by the American Jewish Committee, was an interfaith meeting about how to get food to the people of Gaza. And this murderer, who was – somebody who was inside, he was an American citizen who was incited by all this incendiary language of murder, which has become commonplace on American campuses. These kids who are saying globalize the intifada or from the river to the sea or free Palestine by any means
and
necessary.
And he yelled that, free Palestine.
Yeah, these kids are calling for murder. And so incitement to murder isn't speech. It is action, and so, there is a clear result of this madness with the tragic death of Sarah and Yaron.
And absolutely, and by the way, he was a Christian, so
yes.
this guy was proud of it. He goes, "I'm not armed, come get me," and people think he's a hero. And this guy was part of a group that was financed by China. China was one of the financing of this group in Chicago. It's crazy.
China, Russia, Qatar are funding divisiveness in our society. If we let them, if we say, all right, and now the Trump administration is saying we don't want to have any regulation of social media, where this is happening is on social media. So if we're saying there can be no governance of social media, and China, Russia, and Iran are using social media as the exact vehicle for creating these kinds of divisions.
I mean, they just get directly in touch with them. I don't even think they need to see a post on Meta or Facebook. But what I'm saying is we have to be smarter about the things I just mentioned, about the farmland, about the military bases, about wondering who's coming here, and then also about these groups. Excuse me. When we were cracking down, when it was the war on terror, first thing we did is try to unwind Hamas, right, and try to find out who's funding Hamas and Hezbollah here. We did a great job with accountants, forensic accountants.
We need to do.
We could do that and go right back to the head of the spear.
We should, and President Trump, to his credit, previously talked about Qatar as one of the spigots for funding for this extreme.
How do you view Qatar?
I think I have a lot of questions about Qatar, the funding for extremism around the world. So I'm extremely cautious. I have a higher view of the United Arab Emirates by far than Qatar. And I'm deeply concerned if the president of the United States is getting a $400 million plane, because we should be actually the same criteria that we're saying we should apply to China and Russia, which we haven't. We should also apply to Qatar. And I just think that America needs to wake up that the world that we are facing now is a much more dangerous world. And we had these, in retrospect, fantasies of openness, that openness and liberalism would embrace everybody and we'd all kind of come together. And certainly China and Russia and others have used our openness against ourselves. And so the challenge for us is, how do we protect our system of values and our system of governance while we fight against these adversaries?
Patriot Act. And people are upset about the Patriot Act, but that's what George Bush put in place. Jamie Metzl's here. A couple more minutes when we get back, including, was Joe Biden ever in charge of his administration? Don't move.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. So we're going to talk to Jamie Metzl just about where his party is right now, the Democratic Party, in light of the Jake Tapper book and Alex Thompson book, who reveals more details about President Biden really not being in charge, not even cabinet secretaries, no one really able to get to Biden. And now we have a bunch of people trying to spin their way out of it. Pete Buttigieg, who grew a beard, I guess, and wants to remake himself, was asked this. Cut 12.
What do you think y'all should have done differently?
One, for the love of God, figure out a way to get the schools open sooner. Obviously, pay more attention to the border. That's real, and that's going to be something that you can't just, like, take your time to deal with. Three, even though you spent your entire political lifetime believing that the economy and jobs are the same thing, remember that prices is just as big a part of the economy. It just hasn't come up much in the last 40 years.
So what do you think of Mayor Pete? He says that the economy, I guess, what the Bidenomics wasn't working. The border should have been closed and wasn't, and schools should have been open sooner. If I asked him that in 2021, Jamie, he would have said, the border's fine. The schools need to be open. Got to be careful. And he would have said, the economy's doing great. Just look at the numbers.
You know, certainly looking back, there are a lot of lessons. And I agree with most of what Mayor Pete said. And
I wish he would have done something different.
All of us in life, we're learning as we go. Do I think that our economy is better off now than it was then? I think we're actually, for a number of reasons, worse off now. But I, as I was saying to you in the break, Brian, I think the Democrats, the Democratic Party, must do a deeply critical reckoning. Our party didn't do enough on the border. All of the Americans were watching the chaos, recognizing the threat, certainly on prices.
We flew the drones. Yeah. We saw the an invasion.
It was insane. And so absolutely that's correct. And as you and I were saying in the break, the biggest thing as I see it was the madness of putting a candidate for it, allowing a candidate going for re-election who just by any measure shouldn't have been.
But you know why they did that? Because they said a diminished Biden is better than a 50-year-old Kamala Harris.
Well, so the Biden people, and I knew this then, were spreading the rumor, you have to stick with Biden. They were saying because Kamala Harris isn't capable of doing this job. And that if they thought that, what that means is Biden a year before should have said, I'm not seeking re-election. We're going to have an open primary. And the Democrats, we have incredible young people. Wes Moore, my friend, the current governor of Maryland, is incredible. The Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, we could have had a competitive primary. And somebody, maybe Kamala Harris, maybe somebody else, could have taken the mantle. This was really a crime.
But it wasn't just Jamie. It just wasn't the Bidens. Everybody was protecting him. And when RFK jumped in, they told him, get out. And when Dean Phillips walked in, they said, you're an embarrassment.
Dean Phillips is a hero. I mean, and that's – so as I told you in the break, Brian, I organized a petition. Many years ago, I was the deputy staff director of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when Joe Biden was chairman and Tony Blinken was director.
Real quick, yeah.
And I organized a petition of former Biden staffers saying you cannot seek re-election. This is a threat to America.
You were always saying that. Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks, Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're there. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. We're in downtown Manhattan. I'd say still Midtown. You're going to see the New York Knicks try to do the impossible, come back from a 3-1 deficit. I'll be at the game tonight, Game 5, and hopefully there'll be a Game 7 in New York. That's brought, get this, just think it's basketball. It's brought, they estimate, $750 million to the city. When you factor in the sports bars, even the tattoos, the people that have come to the city, the travel, the tickets, the revenue from the garden, everything from security on down, that's how much it's brought to the city. So it might be just a game, but that's real money. Josh Krashauer will be with us at the bottom of the hour. We'll do a simulcast on Varney and Company. And don't forget, we got One Nation is queuing up over the next 36 hours. You'll be seeing that Sunday at 10 o'clock p.m. So before we get to Mark, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The hardest thing to do now and forever and has ever been is to cut spending. When you have tiny margins, you're trying to pass a big bill. So I think in the end it will pass, but don't expect it to be as beautiful as the president would like.
Well, we'll see. Big, beautiful bill is here. Musk is gone and Doge remains. What it all means for Trump's economy and the midterms.
Number two.
We're going to see where the trail leads, just like we did in the Biden influence peddling investigation. We're going to do the same thing with this auto pen. Who was giving the authority for use of the auto pen?
James Comer, Nothing But Facts, Biden confidants called to Congress to talk about who was really running the country while Joe Biden was president. Show up willingly or be court mandated. We'll tell you who is on the list.
Number one.
Harvard has been a disaster. They've taken $5 billion plus. And I'd rather see that money go to trade schools.
Yeah, Donald Trump said that, and he's doing that. War on Harvard getting uglier as the Trump crackdown continues and the Ivy president speaks out and confesses about the state of the once elite institution. Mark Thiessen joins us now. Mark, so we're looking at Harvard against the president. I believe by looking at Harvard, their admission policies, foreign students, anti-Semitism raging, lack of tolerance for conservative thought, arrogance, all being exposed even before they get before a judge. They're losing by fighting.
100%. Look, I mean, this is like a match made in heaven in terms of politics.
Yep.
The idea of Trump versus Harvard, it's like, who do you think the American people are going to side with on that? And Harvard is just making his case for him. So in that letter that he sent out to all the government agencies telling them to cancel the contracts, they cited the case of this Jewish student right after October 7th, who was surrounded by a group of pro-Hamas supporters and physically accosted. And one of them was an editor of the Harvard Law Review. The other one was a student at the Divinity School. The editor of the Harvard – not only did Harvard not cooperate with the case against them when they were brought up on charges of assault, they actually wouldn't cooperate with – they would refuse to share the identities of the other students who were in there because they're all wearing masks except for these two. And the kid who they were sentenced to 80 hours of community service by a court, and then Harvard was waiting for that in order to discipline them. Not only did they not discipline them, the law review guy got a $65,000 grant from the Harvard Law Review, and the Divinity School student was chosen as class marshal for the entire Harvard University graduation. Not only these kids should have been – if they had done to a black student what they did to that Jewish student, they would have been out on their asses within 5 minutes. You know, the school is an absolute pit of anti-Semitism, and good for Trump for cracking down on them.
And in all parts, he also looked at how many foreign students there. It's between 25% and 32%. Of the student body's foreign. Why is that? Capping at 15, would anyone fight that? You think people are sitting there going, no, I want more Filipino kids in there. I would love an opportunity for more French kids to take it over the kid from Kansas City. No way. So the president of Harvard sat down and talked about his fight against Trump and admitting there's a problem. Cut 10.
We think it's a real problem if particularly at research universities, students don't feel free to speak their minds. When faculty feel that they have to think twice before they talk about the subjects that they're teaching, that's a real problem that we need to address. And it's particularly concerning when people who have views that they think are unpopular, and the administration and others have said conservatives are too few on campus and their views are not welcome. And so far as that's true, that's a problem we really need to address.
Is it? Right. So they really need to address it. Take your time. Yeah. First, we have to sue you for billions of dollars for you to even sit down with NPR and open your soul.
Well, first of all, where was this concern about the lack of ideological diversity on Harvard before Donald Trump took away their money?
None.
He wasn't saying that a month ago. He wasn't saying that a year ago. Where was the concern about anti-Semitism on campus before Donald Trump took away their money? It's the only thing these people understand is money. And the reason why they're upset about the foreign students is because a lot of these foreign students pay full freight. This is how they make their money. It's like when American students go to Oxford and Cambridge, they don't get scholarships there or pay local fees like the students in Britain do. They're paying full freight. It's a cash cow. And so everything that they're reacting to is Trump shutting off avenues of cash to subsidize their university, and that's the only reason they're taking any. They're even admitting that they have a problem.
Here is as we switch gears. And by the way, I'm not sure what the court's going to say today when Harvard's suing Trump to get their money back, but just the exposure, the getting billions where they have an air endowment, they lose. So let's talk about the big, beautiful bill. Elon Musk on CBS, cut 15.
So, you know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the Doge team is doing.
So they have not codified any of the cuts yet, and they are going to be. But your thoughts about him saying that?
Well, first of all, he hasn't got the memo that White House staffers are not supposed to go out and like undermine the president's position in public. His authority at Doge is he's a staffer for the president. I know he's the richest man in the world, and he feels like he can say whatever the hell he wants. But when you go to work for the president of the United States, sometimes, you know, I worked in the Bush administration, and I didn't agree with everything the Bush administration did, and I had to write the speeches, sometimes making arguments that I personally would not be making at that. But I worked for George W. Bush. He got millions of votes. I got none. Right. Elon Musk got zero votes in the last election. Donald
what about
Trump
the substance
did.
Of what so, he's saying?
You know, one of the problems with a big, beautiful bill is that, I mean, as you had Britt Hume saying, you know, when it gets to the process, it gets less beautiful. You've got to make compromises. The SALT deduction, you know, raising the SALT deduction, terrible, terrible idea, except Mike Lawler needs to win his election, right? And our majority depends on Mike Lawler keeping his seat in New York. And so you make compromises. That's what politics is making compromises. And the reality is that Donald Trump won this election because he brought millions of new voters into the Republican Party by promising that he would eliminate taxes on tips, he'd eliminate taxes on overtime, that he would eliminate taxes on Social Security for working class people. And he's got to deliver on that. And you've got to pay for that somehow. And those voters, you know, the Republican Party has become a working class party. The working class isn't necessarily against government spending. Right. This is part of the transformation of the GOP is that we're not party of spending hawks. We would anymore. If you want the populist remake of the Republican Party, you got to take all of it. You know, I personally want less spending. I'm still a fiscal hawk, and I'm still I want pro-growth tax. I want less spending. And what we're getting is tax cuts for working class voters and more spending to some extent, or less increases, you know, smaller increase in spending. But that's just the way the new world works. And, you know, you can't say you're for the populist revolution that put Donald Trump in the White House and not be willing to pay for it.
So remember, it was 8 years ago when President Trump gets in the White House and there was this plot to unearth him. And first it said he was a client of Vladimir Putin. He is basically put there to run America like Russia. And we heard about this for 2.5-3 years. The Mueller report alleviated it. And more details come on in the operation to destroy Donald Trump. Kash Patel, now FBI director, and I talked to Dan Bongino, assistant today live on camera. They are finding crossfire hurricanes even more insidious than they thought. Cut 34.
This is about crossfire hurricane. You just talked mm-hmm. about that. All that you've been learning. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little of that wave of transparency?
Absolutely. So just quickly on Crossfire Hurricane, that is a continuing production. We have found material, and I'm the Crossfire Hurricane guy, that I didn't even know existed in FBI holdings.
So there's been held someplace else? Or
that's been stashed away in locations that people thought we wouldn't find it because we wouldn't know to look for it there. And as promised with my congressional partners, I'm working with Congress on constitutional oversight because that's what the American people deserve. And those documentations have been flowing to Congress nonstop on a rolling basis since that interview.
So it's, you know, Comey, McCabe, Hillary Clinton, maybe Barack Obama. Joe Biden was in a few of those meetings. We're going to find out about a very formal plot to destroy Trump and get him impeached before he could finish one term, let alone the impeachment that followed, let alone what happened after with the pandemic and everything through January 6th.
So if you think about this, the Democrats came and they carried out this campaign of destruction with the Russia collusion conspiracy theory, which they spent 2 years trying to destroy the Trump presidency, and it turned out to be nothing more than a conspiracy theory. And we got to get to the bottom of where that came from, where that happened, how it happened. And then they came into power and carried out the second greatest political scandal of my lifetime, which is the cover of Joe Biden's mental deficiency. So they during the Trump presidency, they tried to destroy him with false charges of collusion with Russia. And then they put in a weakened Bernie's president and told us that he was doing mental jumping jacks in the Oval Office. And it turns out that he probably couldn't have survived a second term, and yet they were pushing him for a second term. I mean, the worst part of it is I expect the left to do this kind of dirty politics.
It was the way the media went along with it. And Biden is gone. The people who did Crossfire Hurricane are gone. The Biden officials are gone, and they should be called to account. But the media, the people who enabled this in the media are still there.
Jake Tapper's cashing in on it. Did he ever apologize for Russia? Did he ever apologize for the laptop, yelling at people who said the laptop is real? Never. He just wants to cash in on this one.
I would have respected Jake if he had done a book saying a mea culpa. Saying, you know what, I should have been tougher on questioning the administration. I didn't do my job the way I should have, and now I'm doing it belatedly, and I'm digging into it. That would have been fine. But to just say, oh, he said the other day, if they had told me these stories, I would have reported them back then. That's not how journalism works, Jake. You have to dig.
Sure.
They're not going to just give you the stories on a silver platter. You have to dig. And when Annie Linsky and Siobhan Hughes went out and dug, CNN attacked them. Olivier Darcy said that they, attacked them on the air. Jake said, of course, that's, the Wall Street Journal was funded by Rupert Murdoch. He said that stuff on the air. So, it wasn't just that he didn't report it. He downplayed it.
And listen, Mark, even that was late. The Wall Street Journal did that story. I thought, no kidding. And that was in 2024. I mean, we
did it before the debate. That's my standard. If you're saying this after the debate, when it was so patently obvious to everyone, then you get no points. If you were saying it before the debate, you get points.
All right. I want to talk about Russia real quick. It looks like Russia will meet with Ukraine next Monday in Istanbul for a second round of peace talks if the Kremlin produces its promised memorandum in terms for an agreement. Trump has not ruled out coming. One of the things is NATO has to promise not to expand, which is a non-starter. They also want land in the Donbass province they have not stolen yet. So even though they've gotten 100 square miles in the last month, they're making progress by putting everything on the table now. Your thoughts about where this is at? President says he's going to wait 2 weeks. But I really would love to see massive sanctions now. Or let me tell you exactly what will happen if these peace talks don't work.
Yeah, that's why the Congress should pass the sanctions bill, because it would increase Trump's leverage at the negotiating table. Look, Trump is making a final push for sanctions, but his patience is running for a peace deal. But his patience with Putin is obviously running thin. And Putin is trying to tap him along and not say no, because he knows what the consequences will be of saying no. If Congress passes this bill, you don't even have one of the things that people understand is Congress can pass the bill and Thune can hold it at the desk and not send it to the president for signature or veto, and just pass it, include arms sales in it as well. Because what Trump has promised is if Putin says no to peace, he's going to sanction the hell out of their oil, do secondary sanctions on China and India for buying it, and he's going to arm the Ukrainians. So put that all in a bill, pass it in both houses with bipartisan overwhelming majorities, and back the president in his negotiation. It should be called the Trump Negotiation Enhancement Act.
Listen, I'm all for it. I think that Vladimir Putin has made the president look bad when he gave him an off ramp and took tremendous political hits for doing it. And now he's going to lose his best Western ally, not an ally, somebody he could work with. And I thought he realized it. And maybe he's not capable of. And maybe that's the story that's going to be written. I wish the Ukrainians were successful and were able to take out his helicopter. They almost got him over the weekend. And I just wonder if we have a Russia problem or if we have a Putin problem. Final thought, which one?
Both. I think that whatever comes after Putin will be worse than Putin, but they're going to have an internal battle for Russia, and they won't have time to turn their attention to Ukraine.
He is Mark Thiessen. Thanks so much, Mark. Very interesting times. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Josh Krasshauer at the bottom of the hour. Stuart Varney in 45 minutes. But next is your calls. 1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Ron Klain was one of the most powerful chiefs of staff they've ever seen. Not just ran policy, he had his fingers in every part of how that White House operated. Comms, Capitol Hill relationships. A lot of people in the administration, and this is where it's tough. Biden always was a little deferential to Ron Klain. There are members of the cabinet and there are senior members of the administration that believe that Biden would not have been so deferential if he had been 20 years younger.
There's a line in the book where he says, "I'm not the smartest person in the room. Ron Klain is," or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, and like that goes back. He thought Ron was a genius back when Ron worked for him on the Judiciary Committee in the like late '80s. So, but this is, I think, also how people were like, "Is it because he's old, or is it just because he like trusts Ron?" And you know, honestly, there's still disagreement. But we have members of the cabinet that do believe, and senior White House officials that believe that if Biden had been younger, he would have been more in the weeds. That I remember one person said something like Biden, like to me, where it was like Biden won the presidency, but like Klain and the progressives won the transition. It wasn't just the direction that they set in policy. It was a lot of the personnel. Ron Klain was very close to Elizabeth Warren, and a lot of progressives entered the administration. And to your point, you know, Joe Biden had long been a centrist. I mean, he was a guy that in 84 ran on a balanced budget constitutional amendment, and then obviously ran, you know, did the crime bill. It used to be a hawk on immigration. And so some people do think that, you know, I think probably like the headiness of power, his age, his deference to Klain were all factors in the administration going to the left of where he had been for most of his career.
So that is Alex Thompson, one half of the book that is The Original Sin about Joe Biden. Now they're saying that Ron Klain basically running the White House. He is. He did leave early, but he still had influence outside the White House. They're subpoenaing him and some others to come down there and talk about what they knew. I don't expect much to come out of this, but I don't also what's going to be interesting is I don't expect Democrats to really stick up for Joe Biden and maybe ask some pertinent questions to save themselves from the stain.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I would say Ron Klain's a very good bet. But again, we're going to see where the trail leads, just like we did in the Biden influence peddling investigation. We followed the money. We found the shell companies. We found the bank accounts. We're going to do the same thing with this audit pen. Who was giving the authority for use of the audit pen? Remember, Sean, there was more activity in the last 100 days of the Biden administration than the first 3.5 years of the Biden administration. Many of the far-reaching executive orders were signed during the last 100 days, and they were all signed by the audit pen. We don't believe that you can sign a legal document with an audit pen. If I issue a subpoena, I have to fly to Washington, D.C. to manually sign my signature on that subpoena. Anything pertaining to the law has to be signed by a person.
That's fascinating, but who are you going to get to admit it? And I don't know, can you tell what's auto pen and what's not? Josh Krasauer joins us now, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief, Jewish Insider. Josh, so Comer is going to haul in the so-called Politburo to his insiders, his staffers, many of which are not known to the public, Ron Klain probably the best, and try to get to the bottom of this. Do you think he'll be successful? What leverage does he have once they show up to tell the truth?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it was challenging for Congressman Comer to get Biden administration officials in front of his committee when they were actually in office. So I think it'll be a little bit challenging to really make a whole lot of news. And in fact, a lot of the kind of denials that we've seen from some of these inner circle staffers, Steve Ricchetti in particular, I believe he was on a panel at Harvard shortly after the election, and he sort of repeated the same kind of denialisms about, you know, Biden, you know, could have won the election and he was fully in charge, and a lot of things that are rebutted by this new book. So yeah, like I think I also think politically, look, there's a lot of hate to be made when Biden was in office. Now it's more kind of creating a historical document so we prevent these problems from happening in the future. But if it's seen overly partisan, it may actually undermine some of the really powerful arguments that they are trying to go after.
Neera Tanden, Annie Tomasini, I'm not sure if she's who she is. Anthony Bernal is this former senior advisor to Jill. They say that she was really he was really, really powerful. Former deputy director of the Oval Office, Ashley Williams. So they're going to come out there and they're going to say, no, he was fine. You know, maybe he didn't work as long as other presidents, but when I talked to him, he was great. So I don't know what's going to come out of this. I think the most curious thing to see any Democrats going aggressively after him to try to get the stain of the administration off them.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a political motive. First of all, like, a lot of these impressions are subjective. So I mean, I don't think, going back to your first question, Brian, you know, they may pretty much say the same things they've said all along, and that, when I saw him, you know, he was just fine, and tried to obfuscate in the ways that they've done in the past. So ultimately, there's no, like, you know, we don't have, like, you know, proof that, you know, people's impressions are their impressions. So I don't think you're ever going to get a definitive, you know, document getting these folks to kind of change their views. But yeah, like, I think for the historical record, it's very important. We've seen in past, there's been a lot of changes taking place in American history when we've learned about a president's incapacity in office, dating all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, FDR in the final term in his administration, John F. Kennedy. So I do think it's important to have a historical documentation of what these folks in the inner circle knew when they knew it. How bad was the president? You know, when was he not able to kind of perform his duties off hours, as a lot of new reporting has indicated? But these are important questions. I'm not sure how much hearings are really going to add to that documentation, though.
Right. And you know, there's so much to do. You wonder if they should be focusing on that. But we would like to know what exactly happening. And, you know, you're going to see Democrats fighting with Democrats about who knew what. And that's going to happen to me. It's going to be very similar to the Iraq war. Remember, Hillary Clinton had to say, well, I voted for Iraq, but I was told there were weapons of mass destruction there. And Barack Obama came in and said, I was always against the war. And suddenly that spot looked good. And that helped him win the nomination. So we'll see if someone could say, I had nothing to do with Joe Biden. And that helps them in their career, as opposed to, I was involved in the last administration. So I think it's going to be interesting. Listen to Pete Buttigieg, cut 12, try to remake his views.
What do you think you all should have done differently?
One, for the love of God, figure out a way to get the schools open sooner. Obviously, pay more attention to the border. That's real, and that's going to be something that you can't just, like, take your time to deal with. Three, even though you spent your entire political lifetime believing that the economy and jobs are the same thing, remember that prices is just as big a part of the economy. It just hasn't come up much in the last 40 years.
Really? Who is this guy? Who is he? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, especially on COVID. I mean, that was like having reported and lived through that. I mean, that was a knife fight trying to get the Biden administration to not listen to the teachers unions and a lot of the people in the White House camp that were obstructing the ability for schools to reopen. So yeah, I mean, it's easy to say that now, but boy, that was sort of the original sin in many ways of the left wing having so much power and the mainstream being drowned out during the beginning of that administration. Look, I think anyone who's tied to Biden, I mean, I think you kind of laid it out nicely, Brian, anyone who is tied to Biden, whether they served in the cabinet, whether they're part of that inner circle, whether they're not, I think there's going to be a big political weight on their backs if they want to run for president in 2028. I think the most effective Democrats are going to be the governors, the folks who have some arm's length distance from this White House. They're not going to have to answer the questions about what you knew about the president's health when you saw it, and not have to be dogged by those issues. I think governors, someone like a Wes Moore, Josh Shapiro, that is going to be the more compelling class of candidates going forward. Even someone like AOC, who's, you know, clearly not always in line with Joe Biden. You know, she was in Congress. You know, she hasn't really sufficiently answered, like, her, and she certainly didn't speak out about the president's acuity, and has been pretty quiet on this. So, I mean, I do think anyone in Washington, anyone with closer ties to the White House, is going to have a real real challenge trying to move forward, especially when it comes to answering questions about the president.
I know you wrote about anti-Semitism, especially with the assassination of that couple that was about to get engaged. One was Christian, one was Jewish, in Washington, D.C. And the thing that they chanted, Free Palestine, is the same thing they're chanting on the college campuses. And now we find out these organizations flourish, a lot of it with Chinese money, just to create unrest in our country. Before we talk about what Israel's doing next and when the negotiations are at, what do you think about where we're at right now, and are you concerned?
Yeah, look, it's a very very fraught moment. Where, you know, if you go to a synagogue, if you go to a Jewish community center, you're going to have to deal with layers of security because of the threat environment right now you know, for American Jews going well beyond Israel. And sadly, what we saw, you know, last week is a sign of just the rot. And you see, I mean, this is why, like, what when we talk about what's going on college campuses, and it's one thing to have a protest. It's another thing to spout terrorist slogans that fundamentally there was a direct connection from the Free Palestine, globalized, the Intifada rhetoric that are, you know, literally out of Hamas's mouth. These are literally terrorist slogans that are championed by the worst actors in the world, and then led to this crazy guy committing the cold-blooded murder of two young supporters of Israel outside a Jewish diplomatic event last week.
So Netanyahu feels the anti-Semitism around the globe, and now he's feeling the pressure to get aid into Gaza. At the same time, he's got to be saluted because you have Hezbollah now. According to the Wall Street Journal, Lebanon's army has largely disarmed Hezbollah with the help of the Israeli intelligence. They might actually be in charge of their country for the first time in decades, who is a arch enemy of the administration, of the Israeli administration, when Hezbollah is calling the shots. So the blue chip organization of the terror units is really 80% destroyed. And now you have the second Sinwar, the latest leader of Hamas, dead.
Yeah, I mean, look, there definitely have been military successes in the military campaigns Israel has conducted since October 7th, the most, I think, prominent being the pager operation, taking out so many of Hezbollah's leaders and then taking out, bombing and taking out of their leadership as well, and they're a shadow of their former selves. That's something I don't think many people would have imagined a couple of years ago. Hamas is obviously very, very much degraded. You know, I think the challenge is, and we see this in some of the disconnect at times between Netanyahu and the Trump administration. You know, I think a lot of Israelis too would love to see a deal that would release the remaining hostages and sort of at least wind down some of the operations in Gaza, so Israel can focus on Iran, which is the stir that straws the drink in the region. They're sponsoring and backing all of these terrorist groups. In Israel, there's a lot of worry. The negotiations taking place between the Trump administration and Iran. We don't know where they're going, but Israel wants to deter and go after Iran's nuclear program, and they're worried that some of these talks are going to allow Iran to defend itself better and its nuclear program better.
I know. You know, there's a report today that they are moving forward with their nuclear program, even though Tulsi Gabbard's intelligence operation says they're not. So Fox News has got a different story out there. So what is true?
Now the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Yep, I'll be able to take your calls just on the other side. I see you out in New Jersey, see you out there in Virginia and Clifton, New Jersey as well. We're going to talk to Stuart Varney in a matter of moments and talk about, well, I had an opportunity to speak to the assistant FBI director last night. Brett Baer spoke to Kash Patel, the director of the FBI. We'll discuss that. And the other big story in, I guess, in sports is the Knicks have transformed New York, first winning team we've had in a while, even though the Yankees got to the World Series last year. They don't really feel this type of momentum that the Knicks have felt first time since the 70s. A big game tonight.
Hey, Brian, the FBI has reopened three unsolved cases, pipe bombs in D.C., cocaine in the White House, Supreme Court Dobbs abortion leak. Former FBI Director Comey says he doesn't understand why the FBI would reopen them. Watch this, Brian.
It's a little confusing to me, honestly. I assume that the investigation of the pipe bomb that was found on January 6th was never closed. The FBI never closes such a thing. So I guess it means they're going to focus on it more. And as to the other things, I thought the Supreme Court Marshal had investigated the leak of the opinion, the draft opinion. I don't know what the FBI's role is there. Cocaine at the White House, I thought the Secret Service investigated that. So I don't follow it and understand it.
Brian, I don't get it. I would have thought that a former FBI director would have wanted to get to the bottom of these cases, but apparently not. He don't care.
He is so arrogant. This guy is so in love with himself, but he has to realize nobody else feels that way at all. In fact, in speaking to Dan Bongino today, the deputy director, and watching Kash Patel last night, this guy's even worse than anyone thought, and there's going to be stuff coming out on him. On those three cases, they're working on all three, And there might be a revelation coming forward in the Supreme Court first about who leaked out the decision early that caused so much derision, and maybe Kavanaugh to be targeted early if that guy had been successful blowing up his house. So it's just so detrimental and so idiotic for an FBI director saying, well, we're already having an investigation. What do you mean? What do you mean? We haven't gotten an answer yet. You're talking about 4 years since the pipe bombs were placed at the RNC and DNC. You would think fundamentally there'd be bipartisan support to find out about it. But fundamentally, they also are finding out, too, more about Crossfire Hurricane. I don't want to relive the Russia hoax, but I do like to find out how pervasive it was. I also like to find out about the FBI guys and who they were and what went into them ignoring the laptop was real, making sure it didn't happen, briefing the social media companies to let them know that there might be some Russian disinformation coming down the pike. Ignore it. Freeze it. Shadow ban it. All this stuff was done to the FBI. So please don't tell me you're done with the investigation. That's an insult to all of us.
There's another one here. Current FBI director, you know, that's Kash Patel, obviously. He went after Comey for his 8647 post on Instagram. Listen to this, Brian.
If he wants to come after me, no problem. I've been living rent-free in that guy's head for years, and that's just a bonus. Do you know how many copycats we've had to investigate as a result of that beachside venture from the former director?
Is that right?
Do you know how many agents I've had to take offline from chasing down child sex predators, fentanyl traffickers, terrorists, because everywhere across this country, people are popping up on social media and think that a threat to the life of the president of the United States is a joke?
That's a reference to 8647, by the way, which Comey found in shells on the beach. But, Brian, I still don't understand how the FBI director doesn't understand what 8647 means. That's out of the question.
I mean, it's just absolutely maddening. You know, if you really think about James Comey, we first heard about him when Attorney General Ashcroft was in the hospital, and they wanted to get him to sign off to extend the Patriot Act. So George Bush sent some people over for Ashcroft to sign off on it. Comey was hiding behind the curtain, sensationally, to jump out and say he's incapacitated, don't sign it, and became just as this star of law and order. And I thought to myself, who is this lurch character? And next thing you know, he's the director. Now we know he's behind the plotting and planning and maybe instigating for the whole Russia hoax with Andy McCabe, Peter Strzok, and others. Just when you think this could go away, it's worse. And for those people out there who said, why is Donald Trump firing all these people, getting rid of the National Security Advisor's staff and doing other things? It's because he knows that deep down, not even deep safe, deep down, maybe underneath the cabinet secretaries, there are people bubbling up working against him. And he's not going to put up with it this time while trying to solve what happened last time. And try also to find out if there's a plot and plan behind the two assassination attempts, or is it just two lunatics? My sense is we're going to get more on that because we have the right people in charge of the FBI who I think are going to love not to be involved in politics and could just do their job again.
The Knicks are down 3-1 against the Indiana Pacers. A prediction for the game tonight, please. You've got 15 seconds.
I would think the Knicks are going to win by six and then force a game six. And then if they get back for game seven at the Garden, you and I, Stuart, I'll wear jeans like you do after work. And we're going to go to the game together.
We're going. Brian, you're all right. Thanks, man. See you later.
Get him. I do hope so. And I'll be at the Knicks game today. And so will. Can we say this on air? I can say this on air, right? Brett Baer is going to be there with Harold Ford. We're not sitting together, but we might travel together because I'm supposed to be on special report tonight as part of the panel.
He told you that he said that yesterday on the show.
That we should travel together.
That you're all going together.
Right.
But they didn't invite you to sit next to them, so that's
right.
Questionable.
Do you think that'll come? I mean, who do you think has better seats?
Pete,
who do you think has better seats? Oh, Pete's not talking to me.
How many people are you going with?
I'm meeting one person there.
50-50, I think it's a draw who has better seats. Do you think Brett is in a box, or is he on Celebrity Row?
I think he's probably on Celebrity Row.
You think?
Yeah. And I bet you Harold Ford got him the tickets. That's my sense.
That's why they're going together?
And that's the draw there. So we'll see. See, Brett Baer, this is how powerful he is. He gets Nick tickets, the whole show moves to New York. I get Nick tickets, I find a way to get going on Amtrak. If I get, let's say, Capitals tickets, I do the show in New York, then I hop on Amtrak.
True, but that's also because you have two other co-hosts.
Oh, that's right.
You could probably bring One Nation to wherever you want to go.
Right.
When you get good tickets.
Which, by the way, One Nation Sunday at 10 o'clock. Also, quick announcement. As you know, with Fox Nation, of History, Liberty, and Laughs coming the 21st. I was on WHIO today. I'm going to be in Ohio. We have a special lawmaker who's going to be making a decision. High profile is going to make an appearance. High profile. I've got to get him VIP tickets, too, because you can get VIP tickets where I can meet you before the show. And then Dallas over in August, right in the middle, and then Richmond, Virginia.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
All right, get ready, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way with a lot of breaking news happening today. The president's having a lunch with the vice president. They will talk substance, mostly about crypto. They both went to the conference. They've both been talking about the whole cyber cryptocurrency and what it means and how China and other authoritarian countries are cracking down. It's an opportunity. We'll see a briefing at about 1 o'clock Eastern time from the White House. Caroline Leavitt will conduct it all. It'll be interesting. And then it looks like Monica Crowley will be sworn in at the ceremony for the chief of protocol of the United States. So this will be a lot smoother, I am sure, than the last time she was there, because she, Michael Flynn, and others were targeted to make their life miserable. And as well as Senator Sessions, who became Attorney General Sessions, and the whole Russia thing was launched. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The hardest thing to do now and forever and has ever been is to cut spending. When you have tiny margins, you're trying to pass a big bill. I think in the end it will pass, but don't expect it to be as beautiful as the president would like.
Yep, and Brit Hume is practical. He knows what Washington's like. You don't get whatever you need. You don't get exactly what you want. Big, beautiful bill is here. Musk is gone. Doge remains. What it all means.
Number two.
We're going to see where the trail leads, just like we did in the Biden influence peddling investigation. We're going to do the same thing with this AutoPen. Who was giving the authority for use of the AutoPen?
Yep, that's a big question, James Comer. Nothing but facts. Biden confidants called to Congress to talk about who was really running the country while Joe Biden was president. Show up willingly or be court mandated with a subpoena. We'll discuss it.
Number one.
Harvard has been a disaster. They've taken $5 billion plus. And I'd rather see that money go to trade schools.
Especially with the anti-Semitism raging on campus, war in Harvard getting uglier as the Trump crackdown continues. And the Ivy president speaks out and confesses about the state of his once elite institution. By the way, a number just came across. Out of the 27% of foreign students that make up their student body, 18% are Chinese. Really? No American kids can fill that slot? China first? Mark Goldfeder is the director of the National Jewish Advocacy Center. Mark, what's your take on Harvard suing back the administration for clamping down on the anti-Semitism?
Their hubris, good morning, Brian, their hubris is just unbelievable. They're doubling and tripling down on the notion that they should not have to abide by standard civil rights laws that apply to everybody. The sense of entitlement is insane. You aren't entitled to billions of dollars in federal funds. This is not the government redistributing money that is owed to Harvard. This is recouping money that Harvard took under false pretenses. When they signed their Title VI compliance letters every single year, they said we're going to abide by all of the regulations, including the regulations about not fostering anti-Semitic sentiments on campus.
And Mark, I know you represent Mark and Sarah Yaron's memory. You represent some of the hostage families who are suing, because these organizations aren't like the Kiwanis Club. You believe they're financed from outside our borders. What should we know about these so-called Palestinian organizations that people like Kilmer O'Brego was a part of and led?
Well, you know, taking a step back for a second, there has to be a better understanding of anti-Semitism. If you take a look yesterday at the case Mahmoud Khalil, so he was the Columbia student who was deported. He led the CUAD, the Columbia University Apartheid and Divestment, one of the most effective propaganda arms of Hamas. One of our former hostage clients, Shlomi Ziv, told us that when he was in Hamas captivity, his captors would brag to him about, and I'm quoting here, their Hamas operatives on U.S. campuses. And they would show them pictures in particular of the Columbia encampment. So thank God, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that this person being in the country implicates foreign policy interests. Yesterday, judge, Michael Fabrias, said that, well, he doesn't really understand how fostering anti-Semitism affects foreign policy interests. Well, Brian, it's because they are literally sponsored by Hamas, which is funded by Iran and Qatar and all these other foreign policy interests. Of course, it affects American foreign policy. That's why, by the way, that the State Department actually has a special envoy for anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is not a local problem or a it's a global problem. And we need to understand it that way if you want to understand the effect that these groups are having on our country.
So I look at the assassin from last week. This guy is part of an organization in Chicago that the Chinese partly financed.
Yeah. And, you know, as that article pointed out, we have to take seriously when people call for globalizing the Intifada. Look, it's not just about the Jews and it's not just about anti-Semitism. Of course, it's also about China. This is really in what starts with the Jews never ends with the Jews. They're the canary in the coal mine of intolerance. Anti-Semitism is a wedge issue to get into this country. And you don't have to ask me. It didn't take long for the chance to morph from death to Israel to death to America and from desecrating Hillel houses and menorahs on campus to destroying the George Washington statue and the Freedom Bell in Washington, D.C. They're coming for the entirety of our Western culture and they're coming for all of America. And you don't have they're not shy. Just ask them.
So, Mark, when you took this case, did you know instinctively or through sources that there'll be an international connection to these pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas organizations?
Yeah, we had been tracking this for about a year and a half already. We filed a similar case in the Eastern District of Virginia last year. Look, there has been a tremendous amount of smoke for many, many years. You can see the influence coming back and forth across the country. But what happens is when you hire these young useful idiots to be your PR agents, you get young useful idiots who are your PR agents, and they made mistakes after October 7th. They said things like, this is a quote from their manifesto, "We are operating under a unified command of Hamas in Gaza." That's really all you
who
need
said
to know.
That?
That was the Students for Justice in Palestine. On October 7th in the afternoon, early morning of October 8th, they released a toolkit, a manifesto, a plan of attack that literally called themselves not in solidarity with this movement, part of this movement. And they used the same language that the killer used last week. Everything, resistance is justified by any means necessary, globalize the Intifada, et cetera.
So are you surprised from your profession, legal profession, that a judge said it's probably not constitutional for the president, for the president's administration to take Mahmoud Khalil and detain him in an ICE facility? They probably says, you know, you could try to expel him, but he's going to get his day. He's going to get his hearing, but you can't hold him up. Your thoughts about that?
You know, it took me a little bit, but I read the entire 106-page opinion, and I can tell you it's sad more than anything else. It shows a complete lack of understanding of the nature of this problem and the seriousness with which you should take what's happening here. The core part is, he says, the Secretary of State's determination that there is a foreign policy interest here, he doesn't see it. Well, first of all, he doesn't have to see it. The Secretary of State is the one that Congress empowered to make that determination because he has more information, obviously, than this judge does. But, you know, it's a complete failure to understand that international movements like the BDS movement, like the foreign terrorist organizations, directly fuel domestic anti-Semitism and vice versa. It's just a very narrow viewpoint that is unfortunately what leads to Jews being shot in the streets.
I mean, put it this way, Mark. Let's just think logically. Even without the ties and the proven connections, the day after the October 7th attacks, there are protests in Times Square against Israel. They didn't even start hitting back yet. So why are you not protesting for Israel after you're putting babies in ovens, chopping off heads of people, but they're protesting against the reaction before there was a reaction? But somebody actually beat you to the punch when it comes to anti-Semitism on campus. It was Andy McCarthy. Here's what the former Southern District of New York prosecutor said.
The most important project that the Muslim Brotherhood has ever had in the United States was the Muslim Students Associations, which were begun with just really a handful of campuses in the Midwest in the 1960s. They have grown in the ensuing 60 years to the point where they have multiple chapters on almost every United States and Canadian college campus. And they are, they're basically a factory for Sharia supremacist and anti-Semitic literature. I mean, that's basically what it's all about. So they've been spewing this stuff out for three generations.
2 years ago,
He's 100% correct. They're masters of propaganda. You know, in 1988, when they started a lot of these American groups, and then in 1993 at the Philadelphia conference, where the FBI got recordings, they said, we're going to put these people in place. We're going to use propaganda. We're going to say one thing in English and one thing in Arabic. We're going to make sure that people don't understand what we're doing. They said that war is deception. We have all of these recordings. It's why the FBI won't work with CARE anymore, because they were unindicted co-conspirators in the largest terror financing case in U.S. history. And unfortunately, they've gotten very good at hiding their tracks. To some extent, thankfully, you know, when they took a little step too far with SJP and those other student groups, because now it's been exposed.
Mark, lastly, it's a terrible product. Oppression. They're impoverished. They have a rhetoric that just basically says kill, kill, kill. What is the attraction? You know, it's hard enough to get a college kid to do anything, let alone join this terrorist organization. How do, especially if they're an elite institution, it's counterintuitive to think that somebody who's intelligent with resources goes, oh, that Hamas movement is singing my song. How do they sell it?
It's a great question. They play on the naivete of these people. And it's a much broader question. Take a step back for a second. You know, how in the world could people defend someone like Mahmoud Khalil, who has been literally fomenting all kinds of unrest? It's because they pretend it's all about speech and they refuse to look at the actual facts on the ground, at the incitement, the arson, the trespass, the destruction of property, the concealment of weapons, all kinds of things, actual crimes. They only want to talk about it at this 50,000 foot level. They do the same thing when they talk about Hamas. They're not talking about the fact that Hamas literally throws gays off of the rooftops or that women are brutalized. They don't talk about any of the lack of freedoms. They talk about Hamas as if it's some kind of utopic paradise in the Middle East. They refuse to look at the facts on the ground. So when you look at, when you tell people these naive stories and you refuse to show them the facts, whether it's here or whether it's in the Middle East, they get confused. And preying on useful idiots is a tactic that unfortunately works.
There's a story today that one of the hostages said that as soon as Trump got elected, the Hamas started treating them better because they fear Trump, because they know Trump wanted to get the hostages out. They said they stopped denying us food and water and stopped spitting in our faces and doing horrendous things. So does that line up with what you've been hearing?
100%. Peace through strength is the operative model, and it works.
What changes now that Sinwar, Mohammed Sinwar, is as dead as his brother?
It's hard to really say, because it's hard to understand who is even making decisions. If they had any sense of logic, none of this would be happening. And so presumably there's another person who's willing to step up, and hopefully they have some, you know, even semblance of self-preservation that they make a deal and get out.
Yeah, well, let's see. His name is Omar Shem Tov, and he, that's what his account was. And he said it on CNN, so I'm sure they were tempted to blot it out and not re-air it, but we were able to get that the verbatim anyway. Mark, thanks so much. Who you're representing? What family now?
We're representing about 35 different hostage families,
and the lawsuit says what?
And the lawsuit says that a number of these groups, including Students of Justice in Palestine, Columbia University Apartheid, and DeVest, are actually functioning as the PR agents of Hamas on U.S. campuses.
And where's the right now? Where's the case now?
The one in Virginia has been fully briefed and is just waiting on a judge to decide on the motions. And the one in the Southern District of New York, we're still waiting for a response.
Got it. Mark, thanks so much. Appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. For those people, it's not speculation. There is a direct link between Hamas and those student campus protests. They get violent often, and I'm sure they're going to be present at Harvard's graduation today. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It is a president's prerogative. You know, people can say, oh, why are you doing that? But that's what presidents do every time. They do it every time they pardon somebody. So I'm not sure why the pearl clutching is happening now.
There's a little booklet you can get from the ACLU. It's called The Constitution of the United States of America. When you want to know, does this pass the smell test? All you got to do is check it out here. See? Because there are things you don't do in America.
That is Whoopi Goldberg, because she's speaking out both sides of her mouth. Not that we should be surprised by now. because she's saying it's okay for Joe Biden to pardon people, but not for Donald Trump. Hey, Donald Trump, one among the people he commuted sentences, two rappers, one gang guy's been in jail for a couple of decades. The other guy is a rapper, been in jail since 2018. Then one of the lines is F Donald Trump. And he says it repeatedly throughout the book. But Alice Johnson looked at his case, saw redemption, and saw that he was willing to turn it relief, recommended he got out. And now, so far, Trump has let out 40 people, has pardoned 40 people. And that in the backdrop. And then we know that Suge Knight came out and said, I think that the president of the United States is going to pardon P. Diddy. I would say for sure, no, because there's no sense of regret for this guy. He just wants to get off. Hank in Virginia. Hey, Hank.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
What's on your mind?
Yeah, what's on my mind is the whole thing with this Russia-Ukrainian thing is more complex than people want to realize, because the whole thing with Iran and China and North Korea, it's all very complicated. It's like the new axis of evil. So everybody wants Trump to act on this Ukrainian thing, but he's got to be very careful. And I'm pro-Ukrainian. My fiance's from Ukraine, but it's a lot more complicated than people realize.
Right, but we know who the wrong party is, and it's Russia.
Exactly. But the whole thing is, if he does the wrong thing, you're going to see China escalate over there in Thailand and Taiwan. If he moves on Iran, these guys are working in concert, and more than people realize.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they are. But I'll tell you what, Iran, we should stop those talks. Almost, they are totally rolling out the clock, running out the clock. Number two is, we have an intelligence apparatus. It says, Tulsi Gabbard says, they are not moving forward with their nuclear capabilities. Okay. Well, today there's a report that they are. It's on FoxNews.com that they're accelerating along with their ballistic missile program rapidly, as if trying to beat us to the talks and saying, well, the talks can continue and there's some hope, the president said. Really? There's some hope? Because Iran thinks that they're getting closer and closer to a nuclear weapon. Am I to believe our intelligence bureau with Tulsi Gabbard? Or am I supposed to believe what we saw on FoxNews.com right now? And check this out. A startling intel gathering of Austrian officials contradicts the assessment of the U.S. Officer of Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. Austria's version of the FBI said this. The Federal Office of the Protection of the Constitution wrote Monday in an intelligence report, in order to assert and enforce a regional political power ambitions, the Islamic Republic of Iran is striving for the comprehensive rearmament with nuclear weapons to make the regime immune to attack and to expand and consolidate its dominance in the Middle East and beyond. You really think they're not running out the clock now? Who do you believe? Thanks so much for the call. I tell you what, I want to see a consensus opinion. I just know this. Iran profiles as people never to be trusted, never to do a true deal, never to fulfill those deals. And I think that President Trump, if he has a preliminary deal like they're talking about, that'll extend it more. Then a more comprehensive deal comes down. It looks like the JCPOA. And he says, well, we're going to get better inspections. For how long? You're really going to let an American walk around in Tehran looking for nuclear weapons? That's not going to happen. I'm really down on those talks. If you want to read between the lines. We come back, Kurt Volker tells us what's happening with Ukraine and Russia and throughout Europe as Germany stepping up big time under their new chancellor. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're there.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This isn't my war. This is Biden's war, Zelensky's war, and Putin's war. This isn't Trump's war. I'm only here for one thing, to see if I can end it, to save 5,000 lives a week and a lot of money, the money being much less important.
So the president of the United States making it clear he's very frustrated, gave Putin 2 weeks to come up with some type of proposal. There's going to be sanctions levied. They're coming from the Senate. It's going to pass almost unanimously through the House. The president could say, you could do this in 2 weeks or else I can't even control my Congress if I wanted to. It's veto proof. and it's going to hit their central bank, secondary sanctions, and others, as well as unfreeze $300 billion in their funds globally and give it to Ukraine. How about that? Ambassador Kurt Volker joins us now, former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Kurt, welcome back.
Hey, Brian. Thanks. Great to be with you.
I guess the story's moving a little bit. Lavrov said on Monday that he'll go back to talks with Ukraine.
Yeah, but do we take that seriously? I mean, first off, Putin's the decision maker. Secondly, they've had, 4 months now in the Trump administration to say anything constructive about a ceasefire, to respond to President Trump positively. They haven't done it. And everything they have said is about setting maximalist demands on demilitarizing and basically denuding Ukraine of any defenses or sovereignty. That's simply not serious. So I don't think we're going to get anything new out of Russia right now.
So they're going to release a term sheet. On the term sheet, one of the axioms is NATO has to promise not to expand, which is a non-starter. Your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. It should be a non-starter. It's none of Russia's business what countries want to be secure in Europe. No one is moving to bring Ukraine into NATO right now anyway, so it's kind of a red herring to throw that in there. But the other parts of this term sheet, we know they're going to want recognition as Russian territory, all this territory that they're now occupying inside Ukraine. They're going to want a commitment that Ukraine is demilitarized. They're going to want no Western military support or security support for Ukraine, and on and on and on. So this is just Russia having an unlimited list of demands because they don't want Ukraine to exist as a sovereign country. Ukrainians can't agree to that. Europeans can't agree to that. And the U.S. doesn't want to get dragged into that.
So I guess a post went up. The Russian side has at least 4 more days before their departure to provide us with the documents for review. So these documents aren't going to be even a starting point as far as you're concerned. And you can't say that Ukraine, even though they're not happy giving up their land, obviously, that was stolen from them, they're ready to talk. So they can honestly say they're not the problem.
Right. And let's be clear here. President Trump said he wanted a ceasefire. Ukraine came out and said, okay, we'll agree to a 30-day ceasefire and we'll agree to a full and unconditional long-term ceasefire. What does Putin do? He lays out conditions to say, well, we'll only do a ceasefire if we get X, Y, and Z. And now we're chasing these conditions. That is not the way we should be doing this. We should be holding a firm line, stop the fighting, then we can talk about making sure the fighting doesn't come back.
So this new chancellor in Friedrich Merz of Germany gives me a lot of hope. They say that they already met with Zelensky and that they're going to try to get them weaponry right away, including long-range rockets.
Right. This is the stuff that the Biden administration refused to give Ukraine and refused to give them authorization to fire at long range. Chancellor Scholz was part of that in the previous Biden administration. Merz is now turning this around and saying, if Russia doesn't stop this war, and they're not, we're going to go ahead and give them these weapons and let them use them. That's exactly what we should be doing. And I agree with what you said earlier about the Congress taking action on sanctions right now. That needs to be something that is bolstering Trump's negotiating position, that he's got a very tough position in Congress behind him.
Yeah, and they are serious about it. So when you look at what's happening in Western Europe, it turns out they want patriots. Word is that we've committed to so many patriots that we're telling our allies, you give them patriots because we don't have them to give. Plus, have they gotten all the equipment that was promised from the Biden team?
It's still flowing. They haven't gotten everything yet. And on patriots, you know, just another thing that we should have done a year or two ago, we should have reprioritized. Because we have delivered patriots to other countries that signed up for them, bought them, paid for them. But they're not at war. They're not defending their populations right now. So we had the opportunity to reprioritize. We still have some opportunity to do that. But we should be doing everything we can to get air defense systems to protect civilians. This is all about Putin's continued attacks on cities that need to be prevented from doing that kind of damage.
What is their objective now? I mean, do they really want this war to go on forever?
They think that they can outlast the West's patience. They think that they can have a summer offensive and take more territory. And frankly, Putin doesn't want the embarrassment of just stopping the war without achieving all his objectives. This is why we need more pressure on him, because he has to see that the costs of continuing are actually going to be higher than the costs of stopping. Right now, he thinks he can continue.
So do you believe that the president is wrestling with the J.D. Vance faction of his party?
Well, you know, I think the president is the one calling the shots. I agree with you. There are different people with different views in the administration, different factions. But the president is the one calling the shots. I think he's hesitating to put tough pressure on Putin because he really wants the deal. He really wants an agreement with Putin. He wants to entice him in. And he's afraid that if you layer this kind of pressure on him, you're going to push Putin away. So I think that's the reason. But you have to flip it around and say, how is Putin reading this? Putin is reading this as lack of resolve and weakness on our part. And so he's tempted to continue rather than to stop. We actually have to put in place tougher sanctions, really squeeze their state finances. And we should also, and we've talked about this before, Brian, we need a lend-lease program for Ukraine. But we let them borrow money from us, pay us back later. We restrict the use to buying American weapons and ammunition, so it helps our defense industry. And it sends a very strong signal to Putin that Ukraine is not going away. They're going to be able to fight for themselves.
That would be interesting. Let's jog over to Iran, where there's a report out today from Europe, from Austrian intelligence, that Iran is moving rapidly towards getting a nuclear weapon. Our intelligence apparatus says they're not. Who do you believe?
I believe the Australians, because whether or not we are picking up the data, I understand the Iranian intent. They have developed nuclear weapons. They have developed long-range missiles for years and years. They've lied about the fact that they're doing it. They have deceived Obama's negotiators. They tried to deceive Trump's negotiators, although he pulled the plug on this in his first term. They are determined to do this, and it is exactly the kind of pressure and force on Iran that we're seeing now, the threat that, look, I can hold off Israel for only so long. But if you keep this up, you're going to be the one paying the consequences. That I think, can be effective with Iran if we're serious about that.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens. And with yesterday, the president basically confirmed that he had to tell Netanyahu, don't bomb Iran yet. How long are they going to be kept at bay?
Well, I think President Trump wants to give the Iranians a couple of weeks, like he said to President Putin. Give them a little time, let them calculate their odds. But I think we face a very real threat of pressure on Iran right now. With Putin, it always seems to be another couple weeks, another week, no real turning the screws. I hope Congress changes that. But with Iran, I do think it's going to be rather short term, because I think President Trump knows the Ayatollahs need to feel that pressure.
I guess so. Ambassador Volker, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Brian. Thank you.
All right. So we'll see what happens with Ukraine. Ambassador's coming to us from Europe, giving us the latest from their perspective on what's happening on down the line. I mean, I know people are tired of the story, but at least I could tell you that I see an end in sight, one way or another. We're going to walk away. We're going to start with sanctions, but nothing's staying the same. Same with Iran. The thing that worries me about Iran, they said there's some hope and there might be a preliminary agreement. And here we go again. And every day that we wait and delay, we end up like North Korea. Remember, George W. Bush and Barack Obama said that North Korea will never have a nuclear weapon. Guess what? They have one, and now we all accept it. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Mr. President, Wall Street analysts have coined a new term called the taco trade. They're saying Trump always chickens out on your tariff threats, and that's why markets are higher this week.
I chicken out. I've never heard that. You mean because I reduced China from 145% that I set down to 100 and then down to another number? And I said you have to open up your whole country, and because I gave the European Union a 50% tax tariff, and after I did what I did, they said, we'll meet anytime you want, and we have an end date of July 9th. You call that chickening out? Because we had a country people didn't think it was going to survive, and you ask a nasty question like that. It's called negotiation.
Well, in defense of her, he was quoting what the Wall Street Journal wrote. And I know there's that war with the Wall Street Journal when it comes to tariffs. Not on other stuff, but when it comes to tariffs, they vehemently disagree. But so far, outside a few companies here and there, they're not really affecting inflation. You saw the numbers, roughly 2.3%. But when it came to tariffs and these judges' decisions, the judge's decision did not go the president's way. They found out that they tried to limit his ability to issue tariffs, which is unbelievable. A three-judge panel in New York, so they're going to work their way up and eventually get up to the Supreme Court, which I think will say in an emergency situation, the president's got unlimited authority when it comes to tariffs. But it does limit the president's leverage with other countries if he's going to be wrestling with his own courts. Speaking of the courts, a federal judge in Boston said today that she plans to issue a preliminary injunction blocking the Trump administration from revoking Harvard University's certification to host foreign students. It's Judge Burroughs, who was appointed by, drumroll please, Barack Obama, already granted Harvard a temporary restraining order last week, preventing the government from revoking Ivy League schools' certification in the Student Exchange Visitor Program. The program permits the university to host international students' F-1 and J-1 visas. But the president's going to keep pressing. He's going to go up the chain. Right now, international students at Harvard make up 27.2% of the student body. So this elite institution, not really open to other elite American students when 27.2% are coming from outside the country. 18% of the 27% are coming from China. And that comes as the administration moves to revoke visas of the Chinese students, including those with connections to the Chinese Communist Party. The word is the U.S. will aggressively revoke visas for Chinese students, according to Secretary of State Rubio. Good job. The other big story is stepping aside will be Elon Musk. And he's saying a lot of the cuts that we made in Doge are not being fulfilled and being countered by what's in the big, beautiful bill. He was pretty, I would say that, just kind of matter of fact about it yesterday, saying, look, I'm not for the big, beautiful bill. I enjoyed working for the President of the United States, but I'm going to go back to my companies for now. But Doge continues. But we need to put some of that and codify it into, put it into the budget. Susan Page, USA Today, cut 27.
What struck me about Elon Musk's comments was that he sounded chastened. I don't believe that's a word I've ever heard applied to him before, but he sounded like it had been harder than he thought it would be to cut spending, that the criticism was fiercer. He complained that Teslas were being vandalized and that he was going back to something that he found easier to do, maybe, which is like try to colonize Mars. You had the sense of kind of a lesson learned about how Washington is harder to fix, harder to steer than maybe it looks like from the outside.
I don't think it's harder. I think it's different. But what he's saying is, what he did is, he's very blunt. There's a subtlety to it. Maybe he could go in there, work it, but don't be the spokesperson for it. This way he doesn't become the person who cuts millions of jobs or thousands of jobs. And they looked at him as going in there saying, you're fired, you're fired, you're fired. And they looked at him and said, that's Elon Musk doing it. He became the bad guy in all of it. But Elon Musk coming out saying, I'm not good for the big, beautiful bill, is not helpful, but it's really not that hurtful. I know Mark Thiessen told us earlier, you know, you work for the president, you don't come out against something like that. But that's just the nature of Elon Musk. He's not a conservative. He's not a liberal. He's a business person who's pro-American. Ari Fleischer weighed in on what it all means and what has to happen for the midterms not to be the disaster the party in power usually experiences. Cut 24.
Here's the other kicker. 115 million people voted in the 2022 midterm. 155 million voted in the 2024 presidential. Trump voters don't show up in the midterms. The Democrats who hate Trump do show up. Mm. And that's the big problem Republicans have. They're going to have to work on their turnout machine, excite people. And can they do it without Donald Trump on the ballot? Donald Trump's going to have to personally work real hard to deliver a lot of these votes for Republicans to get Trump voters out, especially in those marginal congressional races.
And there's a theory there, and we discussed it yesterday, that perhaps the best thing to happen to Democrats would be to not take the House. Senate seems very unlikely, but not take the House. You know, New Hampshire will be a struggle. Georgia will be a fight. But we'll see what other seats are open. But they have 53 seats right now, so they have a little bit of margin for error. But if you go ahead and flip the house. It becomes an investigation mall. Everybody's going to want an oversight investigation. Everybody's going to want to headline some type of, have some type of subpoena. Everyone's going to want to be televised in some type of hearing talking about how Donald Trump should be impeached and this Secretary of State should be kicked out and Pete Hegseth should be thrown out and the same thing we're going to see. And guess what happens? At the end of 2 years, Democrats are going to be identified as anti-Trump, but nothing else. However, if they lose, continue to not have majorities in the House or Senate, they're going to be forced to look ahead, forced to recalibrate. For Donald Trump, he desperately wants to make sure his last 2 years are effective. And to do that and to codify a lot of his executive orders, he needs control of the House. So that's why Republicans got to continue to work on maximizing energy production, continue to push this bill because it's going to, at the very least, ignite the economy and hopefully growth outstrips the debt big time, and then get the GDP going. Jobs will be better, and then you start calling in some of these trade deals. I'll admit to you, I thought we'd have Japan, India, and maybe EU by now. Now it looks like India is next, I hear, but they're sidelined with the Pakistanis. And then you have Japan, who is now has their debt is greater than their GDP. And they desperately want to remove tariffs for their cars to come in here. We're not doing that. So that's a bit of a holdup. EU, big progress made. But I would say the president, with the struggle he's having with the courts and tariffs, if I'm him, I'm trying to push these deals. I'm walking into that trade room and saying, guys, what the hell is the holdup? So I would go from that. Overall, amongst the critics with Elon Musk, Ron DeSantis yesterday on Doge, cut 32.
Doge and Elon were on a collision course with the swamp. And the question is, what would happen? And I don't think there's any question that Doge fought the swamp. And so far, the swamp has won.
We have a Republican Congress. And to this day, we're in the end of May, past Memorial Day, and not 1 cent in Doge cuts have been implemented by the Congress.
Right. And they're about to be. And that's why the OMB director came out and said, we're going to start codifying some of it. The USAID cuts, the PBS cuts, some of the other programs that have been locked out. So they'll be in there. But obviously, they've been distracted by the big, beautiful bill. They'll have a lot more to get done after that. Don't forget, meet me at WHIO listeners, especially June 21st. The Victoria Theater, History, Liberty, and Laughs on Fox Nation. And don't forget One Nation, Sunday at 10 p.m. on Fox News Channel, Eastern Time.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.